Parables of the Messiah, number 15, Two Builders. Matthew chapter 7, verses 24 to 27, and Luke 6, verse 46 to 49. The idea that religion is concerned with doing, and that men need not worry about believing, is a part of the shallow thinking so widespread in these last days. The discounting of true faith is a weakness of the credulity of today, for all men have faith of some sort and are ready to show it in the most surprising ways. The demagogues, Hitler and Mussolini, who had their short day in Germany and Italy, knew only too well how ready people were to believe, and they exploited this characteristic to the full. It has been said, a man can no more run away from his faith faculty than he can run away from his own legs. They are what he does his running away with. The extreme illustration is to be found in the faith shown by so many in no faith. Practice the teaching of Christ and it is enough, would be a fair representation of most people's idea of the religious life. And if we ask, what teaching? We will probably be referred to the Sermon on the Mount. Nothing could better illustrate the smallness of men's grasp of the teaching of Jesus. For, firstly, the teaching of the sermon is hard. It is difficult to believe, and it is hard to practice. Its meaning is not always easy of understanding, despite a superficial simplicity. Its practice defies the best efforts of human nature and reduces men of earnest endeavour to the recognition of human weakness which Paul describes in Romans 7. Secondly, the sermon is shot through with doctrine concerning a future life and of man's possible relationship to it. The Beatitudes promise a good to come which will be the fruit of present effort. Jesus plainly declares he will decide men's future. Some call him Lord, Lord, but do not the will of God. In a future day, many will call him Lord, Lord, and claim to have done many things in his name, only to hear him say, depart. Nowhere is the claim that the future is in his hands more clearly or more boldly made than in the Sermon on the Mount, that he will make decisions which will affect men for ever. It is a fitting sequence to that claim, and a fitting climax to the sermon as a whole, to compare his hearers to two builders, with a marked rhythmic and balanced parallelism, he declares. Therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man which built his house upon a rock. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and beat upon that house, and it fell not, for it was founded upon a rock. And every one that heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them not, shall be likened unto a foolish man which built his house upon the sand. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and beat upon that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. The phrases linked by the word and produce a cumulative effect of the growing strength of the storm, as rain, floods, and wind all seem to combine to test the building. The rock-founded house resists the storm. The waters rushing around its base leave it unmoved. With all the power of simple statement, Jesus says, "It fell not." And he gives the reason. It was built on a rock. In the second part, the repeated phrases enhance the effect of the terror which the storm brings. The only variation comes at the end, and it fell. By repetition, its destruction is emphasized. Great was the fall of it. Its walls gave way, the roof fell in, the swirling waters swept away the sand on which it was built, and nothing at all was left of the man's labours. The address ends with the ominous warning that to build other than on Christ's sayings would end in complete ruin. The utter plainness of it, the staggering demands of it, the amazing claims of the speaker, the awe induced by the picture drawn so graphically, move the people to astonishment. They marked the dominant note. He taught them as one having authority. The language is that of a lawgiver and not of an interpreter of the law. These sayings of mine have all the force of the 10 words spoken amidst the thunder and darkness and lightning flash of Sinai. These sayings are to govern thought and conscience, and so determine the outward act. Men often mistake sincerity for truth, as if sincerity could take the place of truth. Many of the contemporaries of Jesus were sincere and conscientious enough, but pitiably in the wrong. Their consciences led them to do things which were severely condemned by Jesus. Of such perverted consciences, it has been truly said that Jesus was thinking when he spoke of those who tithe mint and anise and cumin and neglect the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. With such men he had his major difficulties. They strain out the gnat, he says, and swallow the camel. The Pharisee prayed in the temple, God, I thank thee that I am not as the rest of men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this publican. I fast twice in the week. I give tithes of all that I possess. He was a conscientious person. The elder brother of the prodigal who remained at home and did his duty so satisfactorily to himself that he could boast, I never transgressed a commandment of thine, was a conscientious person. Simon the Pharisee, who with shocked amazement felt sure that Jesus could not be a prophet because he let a woman of the streets touch him, was very conscientious. The man so interested in righteousness that he tried to get a mote out of his brother's eye laboured under a heavy sense of duty. Conscience so misused becomes inwardly a disease, and outwardly it has produced some of the darkest evils in human history: bigotry, fanaticism, hypocrisy. Perverted conscientiousness assumes many forms today. One of the great evils of this century has been the worship of the state. Germany was thoroughly inoculated with this evil doctrine. Whosoever serves Hitler serves Germany, and whosoever serves Germany serves God. The history of the years that followed the utterance of these words show the folly of the saying, blood and race are not rock foundations. Jesus was himself a builder. It is too restricted a view of his daily work in Nazareth to think only of yokes and ploughs. The village carpenter was a builder also, and Jesus doubtless knew wise people who required their houses to be well founded. Robinson tells of such a house a century ago in the hometown of Jesus, and we may not be far wrong in thinking the description would be true 1800 years earlier. He says, we were glad towards noon to accept an invitation from Abu Nasir and join him at his house. Here we found the rooms of stone much cooler than our tent. The house had just been built and was not yet finished. In order to lay the foundations, he had dug down to solid rock, as is usual throughout the country, here to the depth of 30 feet, and then build up arches. The workmanship was solid, but coarse. He assured us it was the best work the masons of Nazareth could turn out. Robinson, Biblical Researches, Volume 3, page 191. Men build on sand when they trust in human speculations. They build on rock when they follow Christ's teaching. All men are building, whether they will or not, for life's activities assume some shape. But all efforts can have the quality of permanence only if men build on the foundation Jesus laid in his teaching. Some results seem fair to look upon. Humanistic philosophy may produce a refinement far removed from savagery, but the result has nothing of value to God. But Jesus does not even consider or assess such human schemes. His thought is limited to those who hear his words. The hearer who is also a doer builds a character that has abiding value, and it will survive not only the storms and stresses of the present life, but also the greatest crisis of all, the judgment seat of Christ himself. The wicked are overthrown and are not, but the house of the righteous shall stand. Proverbs 12, verse 7. The house of the wicked shall be overthrown, but the tabernacle of the upright shall flourish. 14, verse 11. The authority with which Jesus spoke was divine, asserted or implied throughout all the discourse. The figure he uses in his closing parable of the Sermon on the Mount is an absolute insistence upon such authority. His teaching is a rock upon which men build safely. This figure of a rock is frequently used in the Old Testament of the Almighty. The Lord is my rock. Who is a rock save our God? The Lord liveth, and blessed be my rock, and exalted be the God of the rock of my salvation. The 2nd of Samuel 20, verse 2, verses 2, 32, and 47. See also Psalm 28, verse 1, 31, verse 2, 61, verse 2. Isaiah calls God the rock of ages, 26, verse 4, margin. And through him God asks, is there a rock beside me? 44, verse 8, margin. The claims of Jesus thus clearly suggest that his words have a divine power and that he is able to use the language which God says is exclusively his. No prophet ever spoke like this. Such a form of speech befits only one who has the status of the Son. It is one of the many sayings which his enemies would readily seize upon, that they might charge him with making himself equal to God. The sermon is not detached from history. There are events before and after it, events not unconnected with the claims of the sermon. Jesus had toured Galilee, by word and deed proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom. He healed all manner of sickness and all manner of disease among the people, records Matthew in chapter 4, verse 23. His works were the evidences that belong to the kingdom, tokens of what will be when the kingdom is established. The preacher was virgin-born, chapter 1. Declared to be God's Son, chapter 2, verse 15 and 3, verse 17. Tested in the wilderness without failing, chapter 4, verses 1 to 11. These are the background facts which show what manner of man the speaker was. These facts are part of the record, and the sermon must not, cannot, be divorced from them. But the succeeding facts are not less important, for Jesus descends from the mount to perform a succession of wonderful acts. the details of which one careful expositor has not hesitated to say were selected by Matthew for their spiritual significance. A leper is made clean, chapter 8, verse 37. The palsied servant is given strength, chapter 8, verses 6 to 8. A fevered woman finds calm and rest, chapter 8, verse 14. So he took our infirmities and bare our sicknesses, verse 17. He crosses the lake and a tempest arises. He muzzles the storm as a mad dog is muzzled to control it. On the other side of the lake, he finds men as tormented with disease as the sea was with the wind. He speaks the word, and the demons are cast out. The man who uttered the sermon does not promulgate a law which in its very purity breaks our hearts and then leaves us. He enters into contact with men, healing and strengthening. If his teaching alone would fill us with dismay, with his presence it becomes an ideal not too far away to move us, not too high that we will not try to reach it. The words of Christ find their expression in the Spirit which Jesus Christ even then displayed. Thus encouraged, we must build on his teaching. As ye have received Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk ye in him, rooted and built up in him, and established in the faith. Colossians 2, verse 6 and 7. This metaphor of building, which has its source in Christ's teaching, occurs frequently in the counsel of the Apostle Paul, although partly obscured by the use in translation of the words edify and edification.